welcome to the 386th edition of Travelitch Radio, the show that lets you scratch your lust for travel from the friendly confines of your home. I'm your host, Dan Schlossberg, along with co-host Mary Ellen Nugent-Lee.
Tonight, we're delighted to have as our guest Dr. Ray Doswell, Vice President of Curatorial Services at the Negro Leagues Museum in Kansas City. Welcome, Ray, to Travelitch Radio.
Thank you, and greetings from Kansas City.
Well, first of all, Ray, congratulations on the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Negro Leagues, as well as the 30th anniversary of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. I've been there, and am I right in telling Travelitch Radio listeners that it's like a Midwestern version of the Baseball Hall of Fame?
Well, we think so. That's how our visitors see us. But it's important to note that we don't consider ourselves a Hall of Fame in that sense. The Negro Leagues, of course, existed because of segregation and racism. These black players toiled through baseball. They had to love the game when they couldn't reach the highest pinnacle, at least not at first. So we don't have inductions in that way. So we're not the Black Baseball Hall of Fame. But folks do like to make a pilgrimage here, and they enjoy that experience. And people often compare us to the great place in Cooperstown.
As a baseball historian who's written 38 books, I know how important it is to tell the story of black baseball, and especially how and why Major League Baseball deliberately kept itself all white from the time Kennesaw Mountain Landis became the first commissioner in 1920 until the moment Jackie Robinson broke the color line in 1947. But weren't there black players also in the 19th century, specifically Moses Fleetwood Walker?
Yes, Moses Walker was among a small handful of black players who did play in what was the early forms of Major League Baseball in the late 1800s. There were a couple of players even before him, but Walker was one that didn't pass for white, if you would. He was African American, had some mixed ancestry as well, but he played a team in Toledo, Ohio, and spent a few years there. But by the time that he finished and through early 1900, there was no effort to recruit black players. And there was never a rule that said that you couldn't have black players play Major League Baseball, just basically collusion that kept that talent out. So the black players and teams said, okay, we'll start our own teams and leagues. And that's what happened.
Ray, could you please share the story of how Rube Foster started the Negro Leagues?
It's important to note Foster is a very important figure. He didn't work alone in this, but he was certainly one of the catalysts behind the creation of the Negro National League. First, Foster himself from Texas was an outstanding pitcher and athlete in his own right, but would become a business manager and a team leader with teams mostly in Chicago, most notably the Chicago American Giants. This is before 1920. A lot of success with his teams, but a lot of the Midwestern teams, especially traveling across the country, not able to determine who the best team was because they didn't have a regular schedule, a league structure. Teams agreeing to play common opponents on a regular schedule with postseason, if you will, or any kind of way of determining championships, and to be organized and legitimize yourselves. And so he convinced others got together, especially through the role of the black press as well, to figure out a way to organize a league structure. And that happened in Kansas City in February of 1920 at a meeting at the YMCA building on Paseo Boulevard, which was the African-American YMCA. And that is the start of the Negro National League. And that's the anniversary we're celebrating, the centennial of that great meeting.
Ray, I know the movie 42 had an advanced premiere at the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, and that Harrison Ford, who played Branch Rickey, participated in the ceremonies. Can you tell us what that was like?
It was a fantastic event. Actually, Harrison Ford and Chadwick Boseman, who played Jackie Robinson, and Andre Holland, who played Wendell Smith, and a few other actors were able to come to the red carpet event that we held here in Kansas City. It was a major movie chain stationed here, AMC Theaters, and they graciously lent one of their larger theaters for this event. I think we had close to 2,000 to 3,000 people to watch the film in multiple theaters, but we had the actors here. It was just fantastic. A monumental event, something that I think a lot of baseball fans were excited for, but just movie fans. And I thought they did a great job. The next day they did a lot of media from the museum, so they had a chance to tour the museum and get to experience a lot more about the history that they just helped to promote.
We're talking with Ray Doswell of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum in Kansas City. Ray, I used to take the bus back to New Jersey from New York with Monty Irvin, a star in both the Negro Leagues and the majors. He told me there were players in the Negro Leagues who never made it, who would have been Hall of Famers in the major leagues. Ray Dandridge, Leon Day, Oscar Charleston, Josh Gibson, and many others. In your opinion, Ray, has the Baseball Hall of Fame recognized the accomplishments of Negro Leaguers who missed the majors?
I think the Hall of Fame does actually a very good job of telling the story of the Negro Leagues, both through exhibits and in the ways that they have honored Negro League players. There are well over 30-plus former Negro Leaguers who are inducted into the National Baseball Hall of Fame. However, there are many in the historical community that think that there's room for several more, and we want to encourage that. We encourage the Hall of Fame to continue to consider these players, and they try mechanisms by which those players can get full consideration.
Satchel Paige did reach the majors, but he was in his 40s and past his peak. In your opinion, was he the greatest pitcher in the Negro Leagues and maybe the best of all time?
Some would certainly argue that. There were certainly many other great pitchers like Wilbur Bullitt, Joe Rogan, or Cyclone Williams, who were his predecessors. But Satchel Paige not only was a great pitcher, he had great longevity, and he had charisma, and was really the icon of black baseball, both being charismatic and having just the great ability to win and succeed, and just made him a superstar, and that's why he is so revered.
Mm-hmm. And you know what? I love the name Cool Papa Bell, but I also love the line that he could turn off the light in his room and be in bed before the room went dark. Was he better than Maury Wills, Lou Brock, or Ricky Henderson?
It's hard to say if he was better, but he was certainly someone that all those players you mentioned idolized, especially Brock, who we just lost recently. Bell, played in St. Louis in the Negro Leagues for many years and ended up settling there. And he became a mentor to Lou Brock. Mr. Brock often credited Mr. Bell for some success that he had, giving him advice, mentoring him with base stealing. The joke that they shared was that Mr. Brock would talk to Mr. Bell, and Mr. Brock said, those things, I hadn't read those things in the book. and Bell would say, well, they haven't written this book yet.
Speaking of black major leaguers, virtually every significant major league record fell to African Americans after 1947. For example, most home runs by Hank Aaron and Barry Bonds, most stolen bases by Lou Brock and Ricky Henderson, lowest earned run average by Bob Gibson, and so many more. Whom do we thank here? Branch Rickey, Jackie Robinson, or maybe even Commissioner Happy Chandler?
Well, I think they all played a role in making sure that the integration of baseball was a success. It certainly took courage when you look at the role of Branch Rickey, and it took conviction, and it came to the commissioner. But really, Robinson deserves most of the credit, because even with those folks backing the decision for him to play, he had to be good. And he turned out to be one of not only the right choice in the end, but he was a great player. He was a very successful player. He is among those award winners you mentioned. He was the first Rookie of the Year award winner. He won Most Valuable Player in his time as well. So he just proved what the talent pool was that was available to ownership, and it just trickled down. Between 1947 and 1959, that's how long it took for every team to have, major league team to have, at least one black or Afro-Latino player on their rosters. And as you noted, many of them won, dominated the awards for MVP, Rookie of the Year, and other things. So it just took a matter of time and folks waking up to what was possible.
And we should mention that even to this day, the Rookie of the Year Award is officially known as the Jackie Robinson Rookie of the Year Award. So that name lives on. That was the first time that award was ever given, was 1947. And we're talking with Ray Doswell of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. Mary Ellen?
Ray, even after Jackie Robinson integrated the game, as you say, it took 12 years before the Boston Red Sox became the last team to sign a black player, and then almost 30 years more before Frank Robinson became the first black manager. Is the game still moving too slowly to recognize the abilities of African Americans?
You know, we're in a interesting valley, I think, right now. Because soon after that, we get by the mid-80s, you have at least 18% or close to 19% of the population of black players, according to a study from the Society of American Baseball Research. And that was the percentage of African-American players in baseball. We are down now to below 10%, and it's been hovering there for many years. So at the same time, you have seen a rise in the Latino players, especially from the Dominican and other places. And for me, some people try to make a distinction between the two. I don't, because I think culturally there's much more in common than they are separate. But it is something that is distinct and something that people take note of. And what baseball has done in recent years has tried to make a very concerted effort, an aggressive effort, to try to promote baseball among urban youth in particular. So, and we're starting to see those numbers creeping up, but it's going to be a slow process. But MLB recognizes that there is something is a bit out of whack there, and they hope to get more people interested in the game.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully they'll go to the Negro Leagues Museum, and you have an Effa Manley exhibit at the Negro Leagues Museum. Isn't she the only woman enshrined in the Baseball Hall of Fame? Could you tell us what kind of impact she made on the game?
She is the only woman inducted with a placard at the Baseball Hall of Fame. She was owner, co-owner with her husband of the Newark Eagles, considered pretty much the general manager of the team. And the Newark Eagles were one of the more successful teams in the league. She was a leader through league history as well, among other owners. And, you know, really helped support both the integration of baseball in the end. She was a little resistant at first because she wanted fair compensation for her players integration began to happen. But she's considered a great leader in the history of the game, a shrewd leader, helped put together championship teams, and, you know, was very supportive of civil rights issues as well. So, yeah, she's featured in a few displays that we have on Newark, as well as on the women who had an impact in black baseball.
Hmm. And speaking of the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, why was Buck O'Neill left out when the Special Veterans Committee enshrined 17 former Negro Leaguers at once? Isn't there a Buck O'Neill statue in Cooperstown?
The Baseball Hall of Fame has honored Mr. O'Neill with a new award, relatively new award, called Lifetime Achievement Award. He's not enshrined. He was up for election in 2006, among other Negro League honorees in a special election, but did not receive enough votes to earn enshrinement. But the Baseball Hall of Fame wanted to honor a person like him who wasn't necessarily maybe a player that some might think had a big career like a Cool Papa Bell, but who had impact on the game and certainly was probably one of the most beloved figures in baseball history. So they fashioned the award, the Lifetime Achievement Award, create this beautiful statue of Mr. O'Neill that is really, after you buy your ticket, it's the first thing you see before you walk into the gallery, and a beautiful display behind him that also pays homage to the honorees of the O'Neill Award once they are selected. So in some ways, there are a lot of people who are still very bitter that he's not a Hall of Famer in that way. But as someone else had said, every 3 years they name an O'Neill Award winner. Mm-hmm. Once you're inducted to the Hall of Fame, your plaque goes on the wall. It's a great honor, but you may not get talked about ever again. So every few years, Mr. O'Neill is going to be remembered and honored for his legacy. And some might say that this is maybe even more impactful than an induction.
Mm.
And we've got to mention here that Buck O'Neill was the oldest man ever to go to bat in a professional game. He was, I think, 94 years old. Is that right, Ray?
Yes, that was a bit of a publicity deal with the Kansas City T-Bones minor league team that was here for the Northern League All-Star game that was here. He batted for both teams in that game. So it was a very interesting time. But he loved being around people and helping to promote baseball, and that's what he did until he died.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, he was a great ambassador for the game. I want to tell our listeners, you're listening to Travel Itch Radio with Dan Schlossberg and Mary Ellen Nugent Lee. Listen live on iTunes or blogtalkradio.com, or check out the archive show on Facebook. And our special guest tonight is Ray Doswell of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. Ray, so many great major leaguers of my day started in the Negro Leagues. Hank Aaron, Willie Mays, Ernie Banks, Roy Campanella were just some of them. But who, in your opinion, were the brightest stars in the history of the Negro Leagues?
Oh, well, that's a pretty interesting question. There are some names that folks know. I mean, they know Satchel Paige. They know Josh Gibson. But the one player that has gotten a lot of attention recently but may not be a name that a lot of people know is Oscar Charleston. Oscar Charleston was, even the pre-Negro Leagues, was an outstanding star center fielder who's from Indianapolis. Very fast, very powerful, very spirited player, often compared to Ty Cobb, who, you know, arguably is one of the greatest players of all time, but also known as one of the meanest players of all time, and so was Charleston. the great Buck O'Neill would say, what the old timers would say is that when young Willie Mays came up to the Negro Leagues, and many say that Willie Mays is the greatest player of all time that they've seen, they compared him to Oscar Charleston.
So talking of the brightest stars, that East-West game was a Negro Leagues All-Star game that drew tremendous crowds. I know it's covered well in your museum, but please share with our listeners who might not know about it.
So what's notable is that 1933 was actually a bit of a renaissance year for the Black Leagues. They actually, many of the leagues that were operating had folded around between 1929 and 1931, or at least paused or went on hiatus, partly due to the Great Depression. So in 1933, there was a rebound and reformation of some of the leagues, particularly the Negro National League, and a reform of a new Negro American League. And so in 1933, under the leadership of Gus Greenlee, who was one of the team owners in Pittsburgh, they came up with hosting an All-Star game, which was the same year as the first Major League Baseball All-Star game.
Mm.
But what was unique about the Negro League game was that they held their game in Chicago every year at Old Comiskey Park on the south side of the city. near the heart of the black neighborhood. Large stadium, could handle many black tourists, and the neighborhood had places where people could stay and eat and everything else. And it was really the highlight of the season, many even more so than, say, the postseason games. The All-Star game for the Negro Leagues was really something that everyone wanted to try to enjoy and see. It was fan voting, and some of the greatest stars certainly came out, as well as other celebrities.
Oh, that's great. Let's talk more about the museum, Ray. Does it include black stars born only in the United States, or also from Cuba, the Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico, Mexico, Caribbean, other places?
International story. It includes understanding of the role of players going back even to the early part of the last century in 1900 or so, where actually African Americans and others, ball players, would go to places like Puerto Rico and Cuba, and they would play baseball there in the winter time, Mexico as well. So, and vice versa, if you were a dark-skinned Latino player, you couldn't play in the major leagues. There were some people that you might consider white Cubans who played major league baseball. But if you were darker skinned, you had to play in the Negro Leagues. And there are many great Latin stars like Martin de Higo and Jose Mendez, and later on, Manny Manoso, who played in the Negro Leagues. And they had to toil and deal with some of the same pressures that black people had to deal with in baseball, and had the language barrier, at least initially, that they had to deal with. And a number, as I said, American-born players played in places like Cuba, Puerto Rico, Venezuela, Mexico, Nicaragua, and there was baseball that got spread across the Caribbean in Central America, due in part to just the popularity of baseball, the occupation of U.S. military, and opportunities that got created for black and white players to go down to those places.
Wow, the whole hemisphere.
I should add, too, Japan is also important to this issue, because there were black teams who traveled to Japan and the South Pacific as early as 1927 as well.
Wow. Oh, wow. Do you have a special section saluting African-American players who are enshrined in the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown?
We do. We have these mock lockers that are dedicated to those players and owners as well. We mentioned Mrs. Manley. She has a locker. You mentioned they mentioned Monty Irvin. He has a locker as well. Like I said, there's over 30 lockers, and we're fortunate that the Hall of Fame allowed us to cop photos of the placards that hang in Cooperstown to be part of those sections as well. Now, I should note, though, that there are people who do have connections to the Negro Leagues that don't have lockers. And that includes Jackie Robinson and Willie Mays and Ernie Banks. And only because they're being honored by the Hall of Fame is primarily because of their playing in major leagues. But they got their starts in the Negro Leagues, and we certainly make sure that that's featured in the museum.
So what is the relationship between the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown and the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum?
Well, it's an informal relationship, but it's a great one. Very early on, they've been very supportive of the museum, helping us with photographs and information. And we just see them as a partner within a network of other great institutions that help folk who want to research baseball history. We're fortunate to be here in the middle of the country in Kansas City to be able to help people where necessary with folks who are researching families and family members and doing genealogy work or just wanting to know more about baseball. But we've got a long way to go compared to what the baseball library and the Baseball Hall of Fame library has available to it. And they're a great model for us to emulate. So we're hoping that we can build an institution that's similar, have a research and education center, and be able to provide for teachers and students and researchers who all want to expand our knowledge of this history.
We're talking with Ray Doswell of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. Just a couple of minutes left. Mary Ellen?
Ray, is the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum located in Kansas City because of the Kansas City Monarchs team?
Not specifically, but as I mentioned earlier, that meeting with Rue Foster to form the Negro National League was held in Kansas City. That building, the YMCA building where the meeting was, still stands, and we are working to renovate that building for the purpose of having that research center. So that building was built in 1914 initially. So that's important to us and in the neighborhood and community. So the Monarchs, though, are important to the history. So Kansas City is the birthplace of the history in that respect. And there were people in the community, including a few former players at the time and historians and others, who said we need to preserve this. And they made the effort to raise the money to build the institution.
Wow.
There are other cities. I should point out there are other cities who certainly can boast a very rich Black baseball history, Chicago and Memphis, even New York City. But this is truly the birthplace of the Negro League, Negro National League.
Oh, that's great. And we know you started in a one-room office, and you've expanded several times since. And you're sharing space with the Jazz Museum. Are the museums still together?
Yes, we share a building. The American Jazz Museum is across the atrium from us. And it's well attended as well. And so the jazz history is important to that neighborhood. And I think it works out really well to have the two parallel histories there.
Hmm. And I know we're wrapping up quickly, but can you tell us who were the heroes and villains of Negro Leagues baseball?
Oh, I don't know about villains per se. Our heroes. I think it's it's just really a lot of attention is paid to the players. And you think about it, I think it's important. We romanticize baseball and think, well, every young boy young person was interested in baseball, but maybe not. Some of these players, they certainly love baseball, but you had to love it. You had to love it if you want to play under these conditions where unless you were a superstar, you didn't make a lot of money. You got to travel, yes. You got to be away from home, but you had to do it in segregated conditions. You had a lot of strikes against you, if you would, to use a metaphor. But in order to want to play this game under those circumstances, you really had to love the game. And former Commissioner Faye Vincent was credited as saying, "Thank God for the Negro Leagues, because there would have been no place for those Black athletes to nurture their abilities in baseball. We would have probably seen them doing something else, maybe doing football or basketball or maybe no sport at all. And maybe some of these players probably shouldn't have been playing sports. They should have been working someplace. But they chose baseball. So in the midst of things being pushed against them, they were able to have agency, make a choice, and ultimately impact the world."
Okay. Unfortunately, we're out of time, so thank you very much to tonight's guest, Dr. Ray Doswell of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. Go see it. It's a great place. Thank you, Ray, for being our guest on Travel Itch Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. Summer's over, but baseball has begun its long playoff season, so this is your chance to get the best armchair companion for the postseason. My book, The New Baseball Bible, Notes, Nuggets, Lists, and Legends from a National Pastime, 480 pages for less than a sawbuck. That's The New Baseball Bible 2020 edition. Get it on Amazon.com today. And that's it for this edition of Travel Itch Radio. Next week, same time, same station, same writer, and same announcers, we'll begin a special two-part series on the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage. Our guest will be Richard Peterson, president of U.S. Cultural and Heritage Marketing Council and publisher of The Cultural Traveler, Exploring America. Now, this is Dan Schlossberg, along with co-host Mary Ellen Nugent-Lee, saying thank you for your time this time. Until next time, good night and stay safe.